It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. Mosquitoes are outdoors and they're inside. They buzz around in the daytime, and once the sun sets, they hide in warm places and can hibernate to survive chilly temps. There's no real escaping them. But we do try. What are your tips for avoiding mosquito bites? Do you wear insect repellents with DEET, or do you avoid those? Have you noticed more mosquitoes in your neighborhood or in your favorite park this year? 800-642-1234. Tell us about it. Ask your questions about mosquitoes. Lyric Bartholomew is our guide to all things mosquitoes. She's a UW-Madison professor who studies infectious disease agents in mosquitoes, ticks, and other parasites. Lyric, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. I'm delighted to be back.
Wisconsin's mosquito season, it's pretty typical, right? It builds in the spring and then it starts to wind down in the fall. When do we see peak mosquito time?
Yeah, it's interesting. That is generally the plan, right? That we would see this kind of build up and then decline. But our weather this year has been so strange that that's been interestingly delayed and altered compared to what we've seen in years previous.
What does it look like then?
So we're still seeing a lot of mosquito activity. We've had plenty of water this summer, right? And so there's lots of standing water in people's yards and lots of places for mosquitoes to breed. So so your listenership maybe will be intrigued to know that mosquitoes lay their eggs in some sort of standing water. That could be a bird bath or your gutters in your home if they're not regularly cleaned out. And the eggs hatch and a larva comes out, and then it grows and it grows and it grows and becomes a pupa and then an adult. And that whole process takes about a week. And I think most of us could probably go into our yards or our spaces and probably find some standing water that has some mosquito larvae or pupae in it.
Sandbox pail that collected some water, the inside
Absolutely.
Of a tire you've got sitting around.
Absolutely.
All of those spaces. Mm-hmm. So what does the mosquito population look like this year compared to other years? What are we looking at numbers-wise?
So numbers-wise, it's been interesting. I run a regional center of excellence for vector-borne disease, and so we talk to partners across a 5-state region and hear about mosquitoes. In many states surrounding us, the mosquito numbers, at least the numbers of mosquitoes that transmit West Nile virus, for example, have been lower and delayed, and there have been fewer mosquitoes actually infected with the virus, which has been interesting. Here in Wisconsin, we've seen some higher numbers of mosquitoes over in Milwaukee, those mosquitoes that transmit West Nile. But really, the mosquitoes that impact us most are the ones that are in our backyards, and they're probably about average.
And is that true, too, in central and western Wisconsin? Those are some areas we've had where we've seen some unusually wet summers.
Yeah, it's unusually wet, but it's also been unusually chilly, too. So everything's been a little delayed. The amount of time that it takes a mosquito to develop in standing water is definitely a function of outdoor temperatures. And so everything's just a little off. I think we're seeing the same thing even in field crops and other environmentally dependent sorts of organisms.
Hmm. We're talking about mosquitoes, and we'll talk about how to protect against the diseases they carry. Lyric Bartholomew is our guide. She's a professor in the Department of Pathobiological Sciences at UW-Madison. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're wondering, what are your tips to avoid mosquito bites? Are there a lot of mosquitoes where you live? What's going on in your area? Call 800-642-1234. And Mike from Madison has a question for us. Good morning, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. I've been on the keto diet for about 3 months now, and I've always had problems with mosquitoes my entire life. I'm a big outdoors person. But since I've been on the keto diet, I rarely, if ever, now get bit. And I'm just curious if your guest has any thoughts on that.
Mike, that's so fascinating. I think you're your own experiment, which is awesome. So you have your lived experience from prior to being on the keto diet and your experience now, and you're seeing that difference. It's certainly possible that your diet changes the way you present yourself to a mosquito, right? So We know, for example, that sometimes if you eat a banana, that might change your attractiveness to a mosquito. And so the things that we put into our bodies impact the volatiles that come off of our skin. And certainly the things that you're eating on a keto diet could alter the way your volatiles come off of your skin. So I would encourage you to keep that experiment up. Maybe try and shift and go the other way and see if they start feeding on you again. And then we can start a study, you and me.
Lyric, thanks again, Mike. We appreciate the call. So apparently diet can affect it. But there are times, I am just fighting to scratch my ankle right now talking with you about this. I am one of those people that just gets bitten more by mosquitoes, and it doesn't matter. My spouse and I can eat the same thing. They leave him alone and they come for me. So what draws mosquitoes to certain people more than others?
Isn't it interesting? So
infuriating, something
infuriating,
like that.
Right. So I'm on the fortunate side of being not so attractive to mosquitoes, and actually I've been bitten so many times that I don't really have much of a response to mosquito bites anymore. So that's another thing that happens. Maybe you could look forward to that.
Great. Thank you.
But, we know that there are some basic things that are really attractive to mosquitoes, like body heat, carbon dioxide, octanol, lactic acid. So there's some fundamentals, but probably all of us are presenting those fundamental things out to a mosquito. So there's got to be some other things that make people particularly delicious. And it may be related to the bacteria on our skin, actually.
Let's go to another call then. Darcy in Appleton has a similar question. Darcy, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. Thank you. So I'm just curious, do certain blood types attract more mosquitoes? I'm AB positive, and it seems like they love me. I also have experienced using some essential oils like lavender oil, and that seems to help. So I'm interested in your thoughts.
Yeah, it's really interesting. A lot of people have thought that maybe blood type impacts mosquito attractiveness. But I think the bottom line is that some people are more attractive than others based on a real variety of different variables. And then as it relates to essential oils, we know that there's actually a lot of really great work that's ongoing on essential oils. And there are some components of essential oil mixtures that are absolutely repellent to mosquitoes. And so if that works for you, I think, you probably smell really nice and the mosquitoes aren't feeding on you. So it sounds like a win-win.
There are advantages there. Wisconsin is home to at least 56 different species of mosquitoes. That's according to UW scientists. They don't all bite humans. Are some species more common, or are they more aggressive than others?
Yeah, there's a real range. And so actually one of my PhD students just went through and really scrutinized that number of mosquitoes in Wisconsin. And we've landed on 53 now.
53,
that's our number, yeah. And I think it's fascinating to look at all the different kinds of mosquitoes and think about all the different biology. Some of them even feed on frogs and other reptiles and herptiles. So there are a wide variety of mosquitoes out there, and only a few of them that we probably encounter with great frequency. The ones that are in our backyards right now, in my backyard at least, are a mosquito called Aedes trivittatus that has these kind of racing stripes on their thorax. And they're really aggressive biters, and they'll feed in the day. But we have other mosquitoes, like the mosquitoes that transmit West Nile virus. Those tend to feed, as you mentioned, at dawn and dusk, and feed on a lot, often on birds and people. So there's a real variety.
Lyric Bartholomew stays with us. We're focusing on these mosquitoes that target people, and we want to know what questions you have about them. Do you have a big reaction to those tiny bites? Have you been diagnosed with West Nile virus after a mosquito bit you? Hear your story at 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. The Centers for Disease Control claims almost everyone in the world has had a mosquito bite. And we don't have vaccines or medicines for most of the viruses that mosquitoes spread. So that leaves some people worried about West Nile and Zika and other mosquito-borne illnesses. What's your story? How are the mosquitoes in your area this year? Are they super aggressive or not really so bad? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Lyric Bartholomew studies infectious diseases spread by mosquitoes, among other insects. She's a professor at UW-Madison. And let's go to Lee now in Burlington, who has a question about the habits of mosquitoes.
Hi.
Lee, good morning.
Good morning. Hi.
What's your question this morning?
Hi, I wanted to find out, you know, for mosquitoes or ticks, if I... You know, a section of land has really no animals on it for mosquitoes to feed on. What's their practical range for flying, you know, from a nest out to go find someone where if they, you know, exceeded that range, they would use up more energy flying out and back than they would get from feeding?
Lyric, do they have to return anywhere or are mosquitoes nomads?
They're really nomads, and I love this question, Lee, so thank you for calling. We know that different mosquitoes have different flight ranges, so just like you allude to, and scientists have developed these things called flight mills so that we can study this, where a mosquito is tethered to a string and flies around in a circle as many times as it can until it totally exhausts itself. So we do have a good idea for some species how far they can fly. The mosquitoes that transmit West Nile virus probably fly about a mile from where they're emerging from the water that they're kind of born in. But some mosquitoes are much more sort of homebodies, and they don't end up going terribly far away from where they originally entered into the environment. And it's true that if there are no other animals for mosquitoes to feed on, that sometimes they have to get creative. And this is actually related to the West Nile story. So one of the things that we see with West Nile transmission in the U.S. is that there's this real distinct timing. So we see that people start to get infected around August and September. And some scientists have correlated that actually with the migration away of robins. So robins fly away. The mosquitoes would like to feed on robins. But once the robins are gone, the mosquitoes get sort of desperate and they have to switch their what we call host feeding preference and so start to feed on people instead. So mosquitoes generally have some particular blood that they like to feed on the most, but in a pinch, absolutely, they'll switch hosts and take blood from where they can get it.
What about West Nile virus? We don't have vaccines exist to prevent it or treat it. Most people don't feel sick if they get infected. What are the dangers here?
So West Nile is a virus that can make people really sick, and so that's really the problem. About 1 in 5 people who get bitten by a West Nile infected mosquito show some signs of disease. That may be a headache or a fever. And then 1 in about 150 people get really sick. And part of that is probably determined by age and immune status. So we tend to see that people get the sickest when they're older.
Right. Yeah, my next question is really then, are researchers trying to figure out how to do this? I mean, is this one of those issues, West Nile virus through mosquitoes, that is top of mind for scientists right now?
Yeah, so I think the problem with West Nile is that if you get sick with this virus, it does make you really, really sick. And for some people, exposure to West Nile, as I said, in those 1 out of every 150 people that get really sick, there can be lifelong consequences. So people are paralyzed, or they have headaches or vision trouble. There's these what we call long-term sequelae associated with West Nile infection. So it's really important to try and find ways to intervene so that people don't get that sick. We actually do have a vaccine for horses because horses get terribly sick from West Nile as well, but we don't have a vaccine for people. And our only intervention then is to try and prevent people from getting bitten in the first place. And so actually today, one of the things that I'm going to do is go over to Milwaukee and assist a graduate student of mine in trying to control mosquitoes in the greater Milwaukee area so that we can really understand if mosquito control and intervention reduces the number of West Nile infected mosquitoes out in the environment.
We're talking about mosquitoes and how to protect against diseases that they carry. Lyric Bartholomew is our mosquito expert. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're looking for your strategies to avoid mosquito bites or questions you might have. Call 800-642-1234. We have a question from Jesse in Green Bay. Jesse, welcome to the Ideas Network. What's your question?
Hi, good morning. My question is, Monday I was working around a lot of mosquitoes and I happened to swallow one of them, and today I woke up with a little cold, and my throat is sore. I was just wondering if can you get sick by swallowing one.
Jesse, thank you for that question. We're talking about getting sick when mosquitoes bite us, but what about if we accidentally swallow a bug?
Yeah, so the pathogens that a mosquito transmits, it's always a female mosquito that does that, by the way. She does that really by feeding directly on your blood. And passing the pathogen or virus or malaria, parasite, or whatever it is, directly into your bloodstream. If you were to swallow a mosquito that was infected, then the pathogen doesn't have entry into the place that it needs to be in order to initiate an infection. So you just got a little extra protein by swallowing that mosquito, sort of like eating a little shrimp or something.
It's good news for Jesse then.
Yes, absolutely.
Excellent. We've talked about West Nile virus. Zika, you know, became a global health crisis in 2016. Seems to have faded from public attention. Is Zika still a threat?
Zika is absolutely still a threat. We haven't seen as much activity of that virus in the U.S. since that scare in 2016, but certainly there are still a lot of other countries that are impacted by Zika, and there are some other viruses that that are less on the radar, but perhaps more distressing in terms of how they could impact our greater public health. So that same mosquito that transmits Zika virus also transmits a virus called dengue. That's sometimes known as breakbone fever. So it's a really painful infection to get. And that mosquito transmits yellow fever. And it transmits a virus called chikungunya. So the fact that that mosquito is in the United States presents a risk to all of us for all of those different viruses, actually.
Lyric, you're wearing a black T-shirt with these big red stripes across it, white letters that say mosquitoes and me.
Yeah.
you worked at a camp in Iowa called Mosquitoes and Me. What'd you do?
Yeah, so I have a project in collaboration with some colleagues at Iowa State University where we work with a community in Des Moines, Iowa, that's historically underserved. So it's a community where kids have come from all over the world, actually. Their families have immigrated in or been there for a long time. Their families speak a lot of different languages and have a lot of different cultural beliefs, and those kids work with us to teach us mosquito biology. So we've kind of flipped the way we teach science education to kids, and we show them some phenomenon, and then we go through this process of them asking a lot of questions and figuring out what kinds of experiments they want to run. And it turns out to be profoundly enriching for all of us. Nobody's an expert when we start, and by the end, all of the kids know heaps and heaps about mosquito biology through this whole process. And our goal is that by working on mosquitoes with kids, we can get them inspired to think about entomology as an interesting thing to work on and study. We're also hoping that kids will learn and then take messages home to their parents. So go and be sort of agents of public health change by saying to their families, hey, look, there's some standing water in our backyards. We need to take care of that.
Just dump it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some short-term and some long-term opportunities.
Absolutely.
There with those kids. This may be a dangerous question to ask you. Some researchers are testing things like gene editing to try to wipe out mosquito populations, destroying their ability to reproduce, getting rid of them. I know you traffic in mosquitoes. You work in mosquitoes. I mean, if we can get rid of them, should we?
Yeah, it's a dilemma, and so I appreciate that you're approaching that question with that
knowing
sort
it's
of
your livelihood.
Tentative approach, right? So I think what we've found from all of those studies is that there really is no foolproof way to totally eradicate them. And so recently there was a study published about some work done in some islands off of China with genetically modified mosquitoes. It's really exciting to imagine that we could pinpoint that one particular mosquito that's most dangerous to public health and reduce its numbers. But the data are showing that, you know, we really don't have a silver bullet. Right. So a single approach isn't sufficient probably to do everything that we want to do. So it requires an integrated approach and an educated public. So that's why I like to think that the work we do with the kids in Des Moines is something that maybe could be helpful all over the world for mosquito control.
And that work is guaranteed for a while. Lyric, yeah. Thank you so much for your time today. Lyric Bartholomew is a UW-Madison professor who studies infectious disease agents in mosquitoes, ticks, and other parasites. Up next is the news. Then we take a closer look at an almost $500 million power line project approved by the Wisconsin Public Service Commission. I'm Keeley Boltina. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Wisconsin is one step closer to bringing a high-voltage transmission line to the southwestern part of the state. A commission voted unanimously this week to give the Cardinal Hickory Creek Line preliminary approval. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. The line between Dubuque, Iowa and Middleton, Wisconsin has a price tag of $492 million. The three members of the Public Service Commission say the line is a way to bring wind energy from the west to Wisconsin. What are your thoughts on building the line? Is it the right way to bring cheaper electricity to Wisconsin? Maybe you see a better way. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Chris Hubbock covers energy and the environment for the Wisconsin State Journal, and he joins us now. Chris, welcome back to the Morning Show.
Thanks. Good morning.
The State Public Service Commission voted Tuesday to approve that Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line. How long have we been waiting on this vote?
Oh, well, let's see. It's been about a year that the commission's been considering it, although the line has been in discussion for many years now. I mean, in terms of meetings with the public, and it's been out there. But the PSC's review process, I think, formally began in October of last year.
So, yeah, a long time coming. You were at the hearing this week. What was it like? Tell us about it.
Unlike a lot of public commission service meetings, this one was packed. Usually there's a handful of people, and most of them work for utilities, who attend these meetings. This one was standing room only with, I would say, mostly people who opposed the line. This project had just really never before seen kind of grassroots opposition. There was a lot of organization among various groups who didn't like it, and just individuals. And these folks turned out in numbers just to, I think, demonstrate their interest and opposition. The commissioners essentially tipped their hands early in the meeting and sort of all revealed that they would be supporting it, which at which point a lot of people just stood up and left, even though there was a lot more discussion to come about some of the details.
Did you talk with any of them? Do you know if they left, they just figured, well, the decision's been made?
Yeah, I think, I mean, obviously the decision was made. There was, I think there was a lot of real disappointment and honestly shock. I think there were a lot of people who went in expecting that the line might be voted down. And were kind of caught off guard and really, you know, just disappointed that the commission didn't see things the way that, you know, that their arguments had lined up.
Utilities commission meetings may have a bit of a reputation for being dry. It sounds like there's a lot of emotion in this conversation.
Yeah, I think there really is. I think, I mean, you know, these people, there were hundreds of people, just regular folks who, you know, put in hundreds of hours of volunteer time to dig into some really, really complex material and try and analyze it and make their arguments. You know, there were several dozen, I think 45 groups and individuals who participated in the process as they're called interveners. And basically it means that they're parties to the process. They got to submit testimony, cross-examine witnesses, and so the amount of work that went into it from a lot of these folks who weren't getting paid was pretty impressive.
And how did the commissioners respond to that groundswell, to that information that they submitted and provided?
Well, I mean, they seem to acknowledge the public sentiment, which, I mean, was hard not to with the hundreds of comments they received, even some pressure from lawmakers, as well as, you know, some of the organizations who opposed it. But, you know, ultimately they did not seem to be swayed by their arguments. They didn't really, you know, while saying that it was a hard decision, they all seemed to indicate that they accepted the applicants' arguments that this was needed and the best option for Wisconsin ratepayers.
So they kind of acknowledged that early on, and then the commissioners talked about their votes later, helped people understand where they were coming from.
They all essentially said that, you know, to some degree or another, that they saw this as providing the best value for Wisconsin ratepayers, or seeing this as being needed in one way or another, and they just didn't seem to give a whole lot of consideration, or maybe that they, I don't know what consideration they did give to the other alternatives. I'm sure that they studied it, but their comments indicated that they weren't particularly swayed by those arguments.
Chris Hubbock covers energy and the environment for the Wisconsin State Journal. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're talking about the initial approval for the Cardinal Hickory Creek high voltage line that's set to go through the Driftless area. Do you live where the Cardinal Hickory Creek power line will be constructed? Maybe you work for a power company. Tell us about it. What's your take here? 800-642-1234. Chris, what do advocates say on either side of this debate? Where's the controversy with this line?
Well, the utilities and some clean energy organizations and developers, particularly wind developers, say that it's needed to relieve congestion. I mean, if you think of these transmission lines are sort of like the freeways of our energy grid, and there's great wind resources to the west of Wisconsin, in Iowa, Minnesota, and South Dakota. But there's limits on how much of that energy can, you know, there's not a lot of people living out there, and there's constraints on how much of that energy can be moved to the east where it can be used. So these groups say that this line is needed to enable, you know, thousands of megawatts of new wind energy to move into Wisconsin or just to move through the grid in general. Opponents saw it as sort of a boondoggle that this is something that the owners will, the profits on this will probably exceed $2 billion over its lifetime, and will maybe not benefit Wisconsin ratepayers that much, might even cost them somewhat. And in the process, you're going to be putting another power line through the Driftless region, which is a treasured environmental piece of Wisconsin. And they see it as also sort of crowding out other alternatives that might give regular folks more opportunity produce and control their own energy through, you know, solar or battery storage or local renewable energy projects.
Does this line divide people along political lines? Is this a partisan issue?
It's really interesting because it's not. Even on the commission, you have two Republican appointees, one Tony Evers appointee, all agreed that they liked this line, maybe for slightly different reasons, but all seem to acknowledge some of the arguments about it enabling renewable energy. On the other side, you know, you had four Democratic lawmakers who represent the area were very critical of the decision. There were a number of Republican lawmakers along the line who up until the vote were putting a lot of pressure on the commission to look at alternatives. There really are people from both parties on both sides. It's one of those issues that is divisive, but not along the normal lines that we see today.
How will customers be affected by this? I mean, could rates change for electric customers here in Wisconsin?
Yes. Probably nobody's going to notice it in any dramatic way. It's the rosiest projections the utilities made said it would save $350 million over the next 40 years. When you divide it by all the ratepayers in all those years, it works out to essentially pennies on your bill. Worst case scenario, it could end up costing about $25 million over that same 40-year period. It's going to end up being pennies on the bill. But when you look at all the different factors that go into your utility bill, it's all, you know, lots and lots of pennies that add up to many dollars.
What are the next steps for this line that's supposed to go from Iowa across the state line and end just outside of Madison?
Sure. So there's a couple of more regulatory pieces. They'll need approval from the Iowa Utilities Board, which is, I think, expected to discuss it in December. Then they'll also need permits from the Army Corps of Engineers and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in order to cross the Mississippi River and the Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge. Not sure those permits could be coming later this year, but that's not certain. ATC says they plan to start construction in 2021. Assuming they get all their permits. I would say that the PSC decision is almost certain to be appealed. At least the bar is fairly low for the first level of appeal, which is just asking for a rehearing.
All right. Chris, we'll make sure to check in on this as we move forward to 2021, 2023. I'm sure we'll talk with you again. Thank you for bringing us up to speed.
It's my pleasure.
Chris Hubbock covers energy and the environment for the Wisconsin State Journal. Our discussion continues as we talk about the Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line. We get reaction from the head of a state wildlife group next. What do you think of the project? 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the $500 million power line project just approved by the Wisconsin Public Service Commission. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. And now joining us in the studio is George Meyer. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. He's also a former secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. George, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
When the Public Service Commission's decision happened earlier this week, what's your reaction? Did it surprise you?
Yes, it did. And it's very disappointing. And I just want to indicate this is the only time and first time the Wildlife Federation has joined in and opposed one of these transmission lines. We do this very carefully. We look at it very carefully from a scientific natural resource standpoint, but also an economic standpoint. So our opposition was unusual, and we really believe this is the wrong decision.
What's your concern? How could this high voltage line affect the environment?
Well, there's really two concerns. One is the Driftless area has amazing natural resources. It's well known for that. And there will be significant impacts on streams, forest, and grasslands in the area. The Driftless area's second largest industry is tourism, and that's based on its natural scenic value. And these 17-story towers going right through some of the key portions of the Driftless area, it's going to have a major impact on that beautiful scenic area and the tourism industry that is associated with it. And that's why you had, besides some 45 interveners, which is unusual, there were three public hearings, 2,000 citizens showed up in opposition. Plus, you heard there's bipartisan opposition from it from a legislative standpoint. But it wasn't just a natural resource issue. We really believe this is going to be a white elephant. And we strongly support renewable energy, solar and wind, but we can have that renewable energy in Wisconsin. We do not need to bring it in by a line like this from Iowa. Just on the drawing board right now in this state, there's 4,500 megawatts of solar energy being developed. And between that, the cheap cost now of solar energy and the construction of use of battery power, which is coming right behind it, we can produce our own energy without defiling the natural scenic beauty of Southwest Wisconsin.
Let's go to the phones now. Frank from La Crosse wants to talk about that economic angle. Frank, what do you have to say this morning?
Thanks for taking my call. Like the other line that came through the La Crosse area, it's never been proven that the energy is going to be delivered to the local customers, the ratepayers. This is a corporate investment that the ATC corporate stockholders should be paying for, not the ratepayers. And it's never been proven that we even need this energy.
Frank, thank you for that call. That sounds to talk, you know, really what you're talking about here.
It really does. You know, this line will be passing through the energy to other states. It's going to Michigan, Illinois, and further east. And secondly, we can produce our own energy here, and in a way that's going to be better for the environment of the state.
I will say, I grew up in South Dakota. It's a big, flat piece of land. There's a lot of wind there. So there are areas
sure.
that are better capable of producing things like wind energy than Wisconsin might be.
There is. There's no question about that. And that energy can be used other places. We do not need it here.
All right. Paul from Slinger also has a question this morning. Paul, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. The Nordic countries in the northern part of the EU... many of their high-voltage transmission lines, you know, tying their different corporate power producer, energy producers together, through these sensitive areas, is it ever considered burying these insulated cables in lieu of aerial transmission?
Yeah. Paul, thanks for that question. George, would that solve part of your challenge with saying this line cuts straight through the Driftless area?
It surely would. And I would indicate Europe does, in fact, try to protect those rural areas and those scenic areas by burying its transmission lines. And if you had to go all the way from, you wouldn't have to do it all the way along the line, but when you have really sensitive, important environmental areas such as Southwest Wisconsin, that makes sense. Now, there's an economic cost to burying it. It's more expensive. But what has obviously not been taken into consideration by the Public Service Commission is the economics of not burying it and the impact on the tourism industry and natural scenic beauty.
We're talking about a massive transmission line that state authorities have approved in southwestern Wisconsin. And we're hearing reaction from former DNR Secretary and Wildlife Advocate George Meyer. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're still taking your thoughts on the Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line at 800-642-1234. Let's go ahead and bring in Austin from Woodman. Austin, what's your take on this situation?
I guess I'm surprised that that there is so much surprise that it passed. Because we had a group come, I'm a chairman of the township, and we had a group come in to speak about this, and they had mentioned that there was already somewhere around 80 acres of land purchased in the Monford area, and they talked to us a long time ago. So, I mean, if they had purchased that amount of land, I guess in my mind there was no doubt that it was going to come through.
Thanks, Austin. I appreciate that perspective. George, should we be surprised? I mean, the company owns the land.
Well, they own some of the land.
Sure.
Well, and that's the way things are done. They're betting on having the commission approve it. But that's why we have a process with legal standards that have to be met. And
sure. So it's not a guarantee just because you buy the land, you'll be able to build on it.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. George, will the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation appeal the decision by the commission?
We are reviewing it and planning to appeal. There is a federal process. There's a Rural Energy Commission that has to still approve it, and we've been heavily involved in that process. Plus, you heard from Chris Hubbock the fact that there's Fish and Wildlife Service and Corps engineers permit needed, and obviously those are environmental permits that we'll be actively involved with.
There are several power lines that have already been constructed in Wisconsin, and they were not successfully challenged in court. If this appeal doesn't rule in your favor, what steps will the organization take at that point to try to lessen the impact to the environment?
Well, we're going to monitor if they do build this, and hopefully they will not. We will monitor to make sure that the construction is done as environmentally sound as possible. But there will be environmental damage no matter which type of construction practices they use, and at times their practices have not met appropriate standards.
So, you know, we talk about the effect that coal can have on the sure. environment. There are alternatives. So if this is bringing clean energy into Wisconsin, I mean, cost-benefit analysis, do the benefits outweigh the costs?
Well, there's two aspects to that. And I mentioned earlier, one is we clearly agree we should not be going with coal. But this power line will, in fact, be bringing in some fossil fuel-based energy. It isn't just open to renewables. Coal plants will be shipping some of their power out. So that's one aspect of it. And secondly, we can do this right here. There's a tremendous increase in the amount of solar energy that's been developed and will be developed in the state in the next 5 or 6 years.
This is the next step in a pretty long timeline. What are you keeping your eye on moving forward as you look at that appeal and beyond?
Well, clearly, there will be the legal process continue before the PSC. And, of course, a court challenge is likely to follow.
All right. George, thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you for having me.
George Meyer is the executive director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. He's also a former secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And we were talking about the Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line that has preliminary approval in Wisconsin. We are sure to have more conversations like this as it moves forward. The line is a joint venture of three utilities, ITC Midwest, Dairyland Power Cooperative, and American Transmission Company. For disclosure, ATC is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just ahead, we talk to a researcher about what we miss when we try to understand poverty. We discuss building community and when people can hang on to and let go of family ties. That's up next. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to The Ideas Network.